Saturday.
What day is it today?
Wednesday.
Exactly.
Welcome to Film Festival. I'm Ruth Falkenstein from Falcon Screen, and we are joined by Sydney filmmaker Chris Evans.
Yo, yo, yo.
Freelance writing critic for Rotten Neighborhood.
Hello, lockdown. It's the fourth week, and I am struggling.
Yeah, we're doing a lot of streaming. We're coming at you from Zoom. As a result, we still sound a little different. We hope that we can come back to regular things within the coming weeks.
That's not going to happen.
We were recording this on Tuesday morning, so on the 20th, so we're not quite sure if any announcements have taken place subsequent to then, but we're expecting an announcement from Melbourne later today, which would have happened by the time this goes to air, which will affect the Melbourne Film Festival and retail and certain people and friends and so many else. We cover films, so we'll just cover from that perspective. And also the Sydney Film Festival, which is coming up on August 18th through 29 as scheduled. Melbourne's
I don't think it can go ahead with that date because the program launch has been delayed. So I think the festival has to be delayed as well.
The event can't go ahead with those dates. But let's not like hedge our bets. It's not happening a month from now. Less than a month. It's not happening. Yeah. Let's just be honest.
Without the program in place or without the program being actually out to the public, I don't think there's enough time for people to actually organize themselves and, you know, buy tickets and get everything in order.
Moreover, there won't be single digit infectious cases in the community within a few weeks. There won't be.
I mean, even
so, how's the festival going to happen?
Even if there are, I think people will be hesitant to go out and actually go to cinemas. It's going to be one of the last things to reopen to full capacity, I think.
Well, the Melbourne Film Festival has, I think it's 66 of their slate that are already ready to screen on MIFF online. They may even pivot more online to the extent to which Sydney is willing or capable already to do that. That is yet to be confirmed in any case. However, we will be covering that in coming weeks.
I saw an ad yesterday at which spoke about the festival as a purely in-person thing. Used the line, "It's not a festival unless we're all at the movies together." So they very much hedged their bets away from an online festival, but we'll see how the message may change.
And this was very much a direction from last year. The festival, very clear, they want their cachet is an in-person cultural event. Fair enough. They wanted to go ahead in person and they rescheduled to August. So we'll see what happens regarding that and other festivals.
We'll see when it's delayed or cancelled. Vivid always seems to move in lockstep with SFF. And since Vivid is in September, I think we might see a September film festival, but that's just my prediction. It's not based on any insider knowledge.
I would like to see films at the movies again, but when we can. That will actually have quite an impact on festival calendar if it does move to later in the year. Speaking of which, there are a few things that are streaming online currently. The Geelong Film Festival has a number of shorts and features screening online until the 31st. Of July. The Melbourne Documentary Film Festival starts tonight online and screens through to the 31st of July. Static Visions, a Dreamscapes Festival, which was scheduled for last week, has been rescheduled for this weekend. And I believe a number of the factors will be, like last week, there will be screenings that are in streams that will be available online, but there'll be more up-to-date information on the Static Vision Facebook page and website. And that is scheduled from Friday through to Sunday, excuse me. And Filmotic Melbourne, an online film night, is having their roughly 100th screening on the 28th in Melbourne, but it is available and screening online, so you can get your flicks in. The other big news that happened this week is, of course, Cannes. A number of the Cannes titles making their way to the Melbourne Film Festival, respectively, Sydney 2, Titane from the Raw director, won the major prize.
Titan. I don't know why we're leaving the title in French. It seems to be totally random whether the title gets translated or not. The movie is called Titanium. Titane is like, it's nothing. What does that mean? But that's what everyone's going to call it. That's what everyone's going to call it.
As when it's reported.
Everyone's just going to be like, oh yeah, Titane. It's not a word. It's not a word in English. It's not a word in French. Why don't they just call it Titanium?
Say, Chris.
Titan, right? But no one's going to call it that. So why is it not just translated as Titanium?
Fine.
Have you noticed this? It's totally random friend. Whether they leave the title translated or untranslated. I don't know.
Well, it won. Yeah. And
yes, Palme d'Or.
It won a very crazy, strange plot, which I wonder the extent to which the a couple of the major events in this film are actually plot twists or later developments.
Oh, I'm sure it's been absolutely spoiled to hell by David Ehrlich and friends.
Yeah. At any rate, it's about a person, a young woman who experienced a severe car accident in childhood, has a plate in her head, and events that transpire partly as a result of that event, partly of a fantastical nature.
So cool. Don't read about it on Twitter. Don't look at people's first look reactions, because people decided it was open season to reveal everything that happened in the movie because they were privileged enough to be able to be there at the premiere.
Isn't
it
nice?
That's the thing. Whenever there's like a, whoa, this the crazy, the wacky new movie at Cannes, all these bloggers feel like it's their moral duty to make sure that there's no stone unturned before we get to, you know, walk down that path ourselves.
There has
to be spoiled.
There is some elitism to, I think, unfair to us. It's in within some criticism. I mean, maybe my criticism could be elitist too, but I feel that there's some particularly egregious examples. I remember when Rise of Skywalker came out, there was a particular review which ruined the major twist because they just had contempt for the film and I think anyone who watched it. So here, we don't want you to see it, and here is what happened. It's stupid, so it's not a twist. Damn you.
Yeah, that's a subjective viewpoint as well, right? Like, I mean
it was stupid in fairness.
Yeah, the movie is trash, but you don't have, you know, the right to make that call for everyone.
Take that away from people, you absolutely do not.
Yeah.
Nitram, the new film about the Port Arthur massacre, is by Justin Cozell, Caleb Loving-Jones, with a very hilarious speech, won Best Actor. And yeah, they've been pretty positive for that, so that's what I'm quite interested in seeing.
Yeah, Caleb Landry-Jones playing a serial killer is almost like too on the nose.
Yeah,
he's always playing the...
Let's be clear.
He's always playing the weird creepy guy.
He looks always like one, so I mean, it's not like, it's almost like, ah, yeah, I think of that guy, right? You know, and it's almost that, but...
You could kill some people. No, I he's just played that role so many times now.
Yeah, he's good. Like, he's always been good.
No doubt he's good, but it's like, we must import an actor. The one who plays creepy guys.
This guy. What else? French Dispatch is there, a hero.
No one seems to have cared that much about the French Dispatch,
which I find strange.
It seems to be...
The memes around the cast and crew have taken off beyond film Twitter. I'm referring to the Timothy Chalamet, Wes Anderson, Tilda Swinton, Bill Murray photo, which just seems
right to
have gone crazy. Oh yeah, it's online. The Sydney, Melbourne, Adelaide, and Darwin, and like, you know, the cities in the, and their fashions, and then there was a funny meme about that.
There's some pretty good ones around that. I liked Palace Cinemas had a funny one, which was like film fan, usher, filmmaker, projectionist.
Right,
that was pretty good.
Yeah, Bill Murray's definitely the projectionist. Yeah, you're right.
Can I just say about the Cannes prizes, they went to, outside of Benedetta, they went to all the movies that I was super excited about. They also went to all the films that received the most positive reviews of the festival, going by all the critics' grits. Usually there's a film like Burning that gets overwhelming praise but gets completely left out. This year, Drive My Car, Memoria, The Asghar Farhadi, A Hero. The Worst Person in the World was a little bit less well-reviewed, but was quite well-received as well. Nitaram, again, pretty well-received. And Annette, despite being the opening film, which usually curses you when it comes to the end of the festival and the selection of the prizes. All those films were in the top 5 to top 10 most praised films of the festival, and they all went away with an award.
Annette had Best Director, right?
Yeah, a pretty major award too.
Keen for Benedetta, keen for Red Rocket.
Apparently, yeah, I'm keen for Red Rocket as well, actually.
John Baker, always great.
But yeah, apparently according to the inside gossip, the debate for Palme d'Or was furious, and it came down to Annette versus Titan versus Memoria versus Drive My Car.
That's a good four-way, yeah.
That's a good four-way, right? Like any of those...
Getting, goddamn it, Spike Lee.
But yeah, he did. But yeah, any of those is a great like cinephile pick, cinephile beloved directors, you know.
I still think Dutan is probably lower on the cinephile pick scale than probably the others.
Yeah, maybe, but Raw was a big scandal when it came out. What did we think of that film?
It wasn't that extreme. Like, it was built up, and it was just it was a good film, just an R-rated movie.
It was a pretty standard art horror movie, I thought.
Yeah. But it hit a mainstream vibe. Like, it was for a general release, unlike most of these films.
Yeah, when I say art horror, it's not as artsy as like The Witch, which I don't, you know, consider the high watermark of artsiness, but it was, it was a little bit artsy. It was very French, right? But I agree, it wasn't that extreme. All the media hype about people passing out in the theaters and we've got the ambulances at the ready.
Great publicity. But let's just remember, there's always, all the major festivals have one film which becomes controversial for the wrong reasons and isn't actually controversial. And the ones that should be more controversial get by the wayside, or are otherwise better get left by the wayside.
It is incredible that they gave a horror film Palme d'Or.
Yeah. I'm interested.
It's a bold choice. So yeah, hats off there.
Yeah. So that's Khan. We'll be seeing more.
I'm also excited for the new Gaspar Noé, Vortex. So
I just, right before we started recording this, I saw an article about that pop up on my Facebook feed.
Because that's the one that's not drawing as much attention, but I think I like the concept quite a lot.
It's an Amour type thing, right?
Yeah, with the older couple and sort of a love story with the older people, essentially.
Okay. Good luck, A24.
Yeah, who have reported the sale for what, 2 to 3 billion?
How funny will it be if they get bought by like Time Warner, AOL?
It would be funny, it'll be terrible, Chris.
It would be bad, but it would be funny. At this point, I've detached myself from expecting anything good to happen, so I'm more trying to spin a bit of ironic enjoyment out of all the terrible things that are happening.
Mm.
Yeah, you find me in a dark mood this morning.
Yeah, it's a lousy time, but we'll get through it. We'll get through it with movies. Speaking of which, I'm watching Logan's Run. This will be my 50th film since this all started. Big 5-0. Watched a lot of movies. Finished every single Tom Cruise film. Taps from the early years, underrated. Legend, not underrated.
I know that he is iconic, but why Tom Cruise? I mean, we did last lockdown, we did a Tom Cruise episode as well. You seem to have this drive towards Tom Cruise.
I think there's a number of reasons. First of all, his films and performances are of a general quality, and there's a variance and eclecticism to his choices that it's not just rote action movie, action movie, action movie. He's a star who is proficient across comedy, romance, drama, action, thrillers, and has made fantasy and all of these different genres. And I like that I could watch Tom Cruise and get a pretty good mix of what Hollywood is about. Just a couple of things as a side of just Tom Cruise. Now, having seen every single film he's ever done, he's really bad in films where he's not playing a character who isn't either brash, overly competent, arrogant. I'm referring to Legend, War of the Worlds, a couple of others. His best performances are when he is hyper charming, hyper confident. And there's this intensity and charisma, which often, actually for most of his films, even when he's playing the quote, quote, nice guy, borders on a bit of a meanness.
I think Eyes Wide Shut played really, really well to his strengths because his character has that confidence, but then gets to be flipped around, and his character gets to have that cold, as you say, like that cruelty is the wrong word to it, but he has that iciness.
Yeah,
overly polished.
You just don't feel you want to mess with this guy. He has a presence that goes beyond just a mere physical intimidation. Great as a movie star. And I do like this, like, not just as, like, I watched Vanilla Sky for the first time. It ends very badly. I don't think it's a good film, but I like the scenes where he's this beautiful, successful, rich playboy suddenly gets his life turned upside down. Suddenly he has to deal with this crisis of confidence. And he's actually really good in those sequences.
Mm.
Those are the only bits of Vanilla Sky I really liked.
I like The Firm a lot, which I think is underrated. And love
The Firm is great.
Yeah.
I know what you mean when you say that he seems to sort of represent like the best of Hollywood, because he activates this kind of nostalgic sense. Yeah.
The last movie star kind of feeling.
Yeah, that's it. And you're watching all these 90s movies with their very glossy presentation and lighting. It's like, it's a time capsule of when I was getting to know what movies were. Usually Tom Cruise was at the forefront.
Yeah.
Being larger than life.
I remember the first really big Hollywood film I ever saw. Like, I think this is the post, like watching Disney kids movies, was Mission Impossible. Like, it really did introduce me to a whole world of just other cinema, which I'm still appreciative. But yeah, like, I love that era. Like, Far and Away, the one he did with Ron Howard back in the early 90s, it's all the bad hallmarks of Ron Howard direction, but it's just such a sweeping, epic story with just lovely performances that you can't help but get taken away with it. And like, you look at Cruise, like, who else aside from Cruise, Brad Pitt, and DiCaprio are on that level solely acting in movies and evoke this image of the classic movie star? I would argue Cruise more than Pitt or DiCaprio epitomize that Cagney-esque, Stewart-esque, both charisma but like large and life presence.
Interesting to talk about that trio, because Quentin Tarantino considered casting Tom Cruise in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood
as in the Cliff Booth role.
In the Cliff Booth role, yeah.
Would have been great. I liked Brad Pitt a lot. I'm fine with Brad Pitt being there.
Yeah, but it would have been different, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah. Anyone going to read the novel?
I'm of two minds about it, because as I loved the film, but the idea of a novel by Quentin Tarantino is so fundamentally unappealing to me. Like, he's gifted with visuals. He does create great dialogue, but sometimes he crosses over into overindulgent. A novel seems like it's opening yourself up to the worst aspects of Tarantino. You don't have any of the performances or the by now very sophisticated camera work, but you do have the opportunity for endless dialogue and endless nerding out, endless descriptions of stuff I don't care about. It's charming when you get to see like the cartoons and the dog food and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. If I was reading like every few chapters, I was reading in that level of detail about 60 stuff, which is just an opportunity. Like, with the length of a novel,
show off, basically. It's
the same reason. Yeah. Like, why I like a Tarantino miniseries could be very bad. I feel like have you seen him in interviews? The guy does not shut up. Right. I feel like he needs some things to limit how much he's able to say at any one time. Just get out the best parts.
I'll give you a comparative. I mean, Charlie Kaufman's novel, And Kind, was one of the worst things I've ever read. And it's 700 pages long of complete wankery.
And he is another person who I have that sense of, like, he needs a filter, like a Spike Jonze or someone like that.
Exactly.
And that's getting too self-indulgent.
That's going to happen with Tarantino. I mean, there might be good stuff in there where it's going to get lost in all the
self-indulgence.
Yeah.
Speaking of first watches, Schenectady, New York keeps coming up with my recommendations. I've never seen it.
You've never seen it? Yeah. Okay. The movie that first developed that idea for me that Kaufman is actually intolerably self-indulgent. It was his first written and directed film. And I thought it was really too much, but it's an interesting movie and I'm sort of due a rewatch, but keep putting it off. So if you want to watch it, I'll watch it for next week.
I will watch Schenectady, New York with you. That sounds like fun. Yeah. Cool. I've been doing a few co-watches. We did one of the only films, aside from the Edgar Wright films, the only film I've dedicated myself this whole lockdown to watching first time watches, just as a bit of like something fresh. The only exception I made is my second watch of Starship Troopers. I watched that twice, like 10, 12 years ago, and decided to watch it again for friends who hadn't seen it. It's still great. I wanted to go back and watch all of the Verhoeven films prior to Benedetta that I haven't seen, like the really early ones. And basically, it's done in 4K, so I want to see that again. I haven't seen it since.
Is Benedetta coming out in Australia?
It'll look, I think it's too Lige a release, right?
Yeah, the guy who made Total Recall and Basic Instinct.
Look, if it doesn't...
I just feel like the censorship might be an issue. Australia is a bit more conservative than...
We don't have censorship. It's a matter of the rating system.
It won't be that extreme. I think it's more a question of offending sensibilities. I'm surprised MIF don't have it, but I think it's almost guaranteed to be their late edition. And if it's not showing at MIF, then... we'll see it, I guess, next year at Sydney Underground.
Yeah.
It'll go the, if it's that extreme, it'll go the House That Jack next Built year. Route.
Next
yeah.
Year. Ooh, should I watch The House That Jack Built? Because they're watching all these old Matt Dillon films, The Outsiders, Rumblefish.
Yeah, it's a pretty, if you've enjoyed the recent Lars von Trier films, it's very similar. It's most similar to Nymphomaniac, if you've seen that one.
Yeah. When I was in Europe when this was out and it was playing at every single small art house cinema, I just got sick of seeing the signs. But like, I love Matt Dillon's early stuff, The Outsiders with Coppola. Really amazing introduction to a lot of Tom Cruise, Patrick Swayze, a lot of really big actors got their start in this movie, and Rumblefish, an absolutely stunning film.
That's an incredible film.
Do you like Wild Things?
I haven't seen Wild Things.
It's actually a lot of fun. It gets a bad rap for being what it is, but it's actually pretty self-aware.
When you say for being what it is, what is that exactly?
You know, just pulpy, erotic thriller that's trying to provoke rather than actually has any substance.
Because speaking of films that are trying to provoke instead of not having any substance, and Denise Richards, aside from watching Starship Troopers, I watched Loaded Weapon 1 for the first time, a film that I only was brought to my attention as top of Netflix because there was a throwaway reference in Rick and Morty to an actress, Kathy Ireland, who is one of the leads in the movie. And it's just a Lethal Weapon parody that I can't believe exists, starring Emilio Estevez and Samuel L. Jackson.
It's Charlie Sheen who was in Hot Shots.
Charlie Sheen is in this too.
It's confusing that Emilio Estevez is the lead in this one and Charlie Sheen is the lead in Hot Shots, isn't it?
Very, yeah. I like Hot Shots. Actually, if you like Hot Shots, what's the great film Val Kilmer did? The Team America-esque movie from 84.
I think I know. What's it called?
Top Secret.
I loved that as a kid.
So clever. It's one of the great, of all the parody era, just spoof movies, it's one of the very best.
Yeah. The Naked Gun are pretty bad, right?
Naked Guns are bad movies. They get progressively worse. Let's face it. They were never great. There was a time, Spy Hard isn't terrible. What were the good parody films in the 90s? This is the Lampoon era.
Blazing Saddles was in the 90s, right?
That
was
the 70s. Saddles was
71.
Out by a factor of 20 years.
Yeah. The early Mel Brooks, like the three great classic Mel Brooks films. Like, he's made many good films. The Producers, Blazing Saddles, Young Frankenstein are all just beyond another level to...
Oh, I haven't seen Young Frankenstein. That could be something I could
do. You should watch Young Frankenstein, yeah. These films...
Frankenstein, Chris! Frankenstein!
It's Frankenstein, but it What it's a parody, but it's not like a Hot Shots or a same as Blazing Saddles, right? Like, then they have a degree more backbone and integrity as narratives than some of these more broad parody.
But they work as a comedy for the genre itself. Like, you could watch it as a standalone Frankenstein movie. But
yeah.
I feel to watch these, you have to have some context as to just the cavalcade of Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein, and crossover movies that are happening in the 30s, 40s. Like, it really is taking off those and some very specific ones. Like, these were coming out like Marvel movies back in the day. Like, mm-hmm. Universal just went nuts. Mel Brooks was like, I can have some fun with this. Like, I thought Hump was on the other side. What? Hump. classic, wonderful scenes in those movies. I watched Young Frankenstein last when Gene Wilder passed away. Really just marvelous, some really funny jokes. My dad had us like sit down as kids. Some of the first films we ever watched, and just watched all the old Mel Brooks.
I'll give it a shot. After last week's episode on Edgar Wright, I made my dad watch
parody.
No, I made my dad watch Hot Fuzz for the first time.
Did he like it?
He did, and he was very surprised because he was not expecting it to be that dense in terms of following plot. And he said, I've never had to watch a comedy so intensely to get all the jokes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
How do you not like Hot Fuzz?
He loved Hot Fuzz. It was just different for him to see that, oh, comedy is requiring so much of my brain space, because he's not used to so many comedy films are just, you know, so it can, they can play in the background and the laughs are so telegraphed that you don't have to actually use your brain.
Yeah.
With Hot Fuzz, they're so integral to the narrative and they're so wordplay that, you know, especially like, you know, the hag and the fascist.
All the callbacks. There's so many amazing callbacks in there.
Yeah, but again, like Shaun of the Dead, it's just one. It's not like keep coming back and back and back. It's just we have the joke and it pays off again later and that's it. It's neat, elegant filmmaking.
I had a thought about Hot Fuzz. It's smart in how it uses the ridiculous gore, because if you notice, Nicholas Angel never causes directly any of the horrible bloodshed.
Yeah.
They were very careful with that. He never kills anyone.
They're very, very direct in saying that, you know, I've not carried a firearm in over 2 years. I'd like to keep it that way.
Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, you've got things like not spoiling anything. The neck incident near the end of the film, you know, happens just because of an accident from someone trying to run away, like Nicholas,
that's the entire joke, right? In a village that it's hell-bent and trying to prove that everything is an accident, people then...
These horrible accidents end up happening at the end.
Yeah.
Marvelous. Oh, yeah. I watched Josie and the Pussycats the first time.
Did you like it? I saw that earlier this year.
It's very, very ahead of its time. I think it's a film that could have come out any time in the past 20 years and been as funny. It's about the commodification of music and culture by conglomerates and government. There's a great scene where they shove the cocaine off the desk to reveal like a hit.
Oh, yeah. That was the
villain's lair.
That's the best joke in the movie. Yeah. And that was pushing what you can get away with in a kid's movie.
Yeah,
well, it was like limit. Cocaine.
It was just white powder, Chris.
It's just white. I know, it's just white powder.
Aspirin.
But, that film is pretty funny. I think you say it's ahead of its time, and it is, but it's also perfectly of its time.
Yeah, very boy band.
Great. Yeah, it's about
that's era of music,
and that the 2000s.
It's gorgeous,
but also the super. I don't want to say heroin chic. You know, everyone is just ridiculously thin.
And
Alan
Cumming is just so funny. Like every line, he always breaks the fourth wall just at the right moments, but doesn't overdo it. It's a rare skill.
Yeah, it might be the ultimate Alan Cumming performance.
Oh, that and Boris. I really like his Boris Grishenko.
That is classic, yeah.
But I do have bad news for you guys, so you can hate me for it. But I did end up watching Black Widow
again. Oh,
How was it?
It was terrible. It was actually horrible. It was horribly bad because I think on a purely narrative level, it does not work.
Is it actually like one of the worst?
Yes.
It would be. It
like categorically... As a film, it doesn't work. Not even as a Marvel film. I think as a film, it's categorically bad.
It's funny if it's one of the worst, because Captain Marvel was easily one of the worst. So if it turns out that every time Marvel
it's worse than Captain Marvel.
Right. It's like if every time Marvel make a female lead movie, they just completely half-ass it and it's fine. We get kudos anyway. First of all, it just shows how much the critical establishment just eat up the marketing copy.
Yeah.
Secondly, surely they can do better than this. Like, did Marvel not really give a shit beyond just like, all right, we'll tick off the, like, we're doing female representation.
And
I mean, it's a film that never really
takes any real Russians?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, good.
But it's a film that never really takes off. It's basically a film that's entirely a setup for, you know, making Florence Pugh the next
Black Widow. I think it was weird how Kate Shortland is directing it. Nothing she's made before would say, yeah, you should do a $200 million action film.
Yeah. So we're going to be back next week talking more festivals, more or watching. Anything you want us to fight about, let us know.
We'll come up with a subject.
Yep. Please subscribe on iTunes and Spotify. Have a wonderful week. Stay safe. Watch lots of movies like we've been doing. And reach out for co-watchers because they're nice at this time. This has been Glenn Fowling, Sankaris Evans, and Bharat Nehru. Be well, have a wonderful day, and enjoy movies and enjoy life. Good night.
Good night.